Hello there, and welcome to Star Wars Music Minute, where we celebrate Star Wars through music and sound. Each episode revolves around 5 cinematic minutes, so by the end of the season, you'll know something new about the music in every minute of The Last Jedi. Focusing on small chunks of the film gives us time to explore the sonic landscape of Star Wars in more detail, so we can better understand how everything we hear interacts with the cinematography and film as a whole. I'm Krisanthi Tan, a composer and violinist who loves Star Wars more than anything, except maybe music. And today I'm joined for minute 31 through 35 of The Last Jedi with the one and only Tony Thaxton. Hello, Tony.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
I also love Star Wars and music.
Yes, you do. In fact, you were the drummer of a band that I was a fan of growing up.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I knew I was the drummer. I didn't know you were a fan.
Oh, I was in a band? Oh, my gosh.
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Tony was in Motion City Soundtrack. And I know that you have a lot of fans, Tony. And so there's a couple questions for you for this show as well. We'll get to those.
All right.
But no, there were requests to get you specifically on. So here you are.
Interesting. All these people fooled thinking I probably have music theory knowledge, but I think for someone that played music professionally for so long and then it's just been such a huge part of my life, not very smart with the theory stuff. And I know I warned you of this.
And I kept saying it doesn't matter.
I think my Star Wars knowledge probably outshines my music theory knowledge. But
which
I don't know.
Probably me too. I mean, I'm not a professor or anything. but like you, I come from the side of being more of a performer and then learning theory through, just like letting my ears guide me in what I'm learning and observing. So yeah, just like you, I'm more of a play stuff than write stuff, I'm a composer too, but write about the academic theory side of things, and that's not what's most important anyway. So yeah.
Right. Anyway. Yeah, I'm the same. I can do some writing, but like if someone's like, if I play them something that I wrote, we're like, what key is that in? I'm like, I don't know. I can show you the chords, but I don't know what key I'm in.
Which is quite awful. Keys are a Western construct. Anyway, they totally are. So in these minutes, they're so packed. I'm realizing how packed in this movie is. I'm used to it being like 5 minutes of kind of being in one static scene, but no. There's so many points here. So we start this out with, an explosion in the hangar, and Leia is looking very concerned. She's looking a certain way. And then we see close up of Kylo Ren as well. Kylo has his finger over the button to deploy some weaponry. Don't really know the names for weapons. Weaponry. And then he hesitates, takes his finger off of the button. His colleagues do, press all of their buttons and they blow up the Raddus, part of it. Leia goes flying out. Then we cut to a scene of Hux and Peavy on the Supremacy. And they're talking shop. And then we get that full-on Leia Poppins experience where we see Leia flying throughout space, and this is the point in the theater where I was like, this is how she dies.
Yeah.
So you see her body literally float through space, and it is kind of shocking to see that shot at first.
Yes. And then, I agree 100%.
Yeah. And then we get like a close-up on her floating, and lo and behold, she uses the Force to tractor beam herself back to the ship, and where she immediately is, she's in a coma and they shuttle her away. And then we cut to Chewie on Octo roasting a porg on the campfire, and the porgs look at him very pitifully, and he puts it down. And then, this is still the same 5 minutes. Then Luke goes on the Millennium Falcon. And we have some touchy-feely moments. R2's there. Han's gold dice are there. R2 plays Leia's hologram message from A New Hope. It's the whole thing.
Yeah. Watching these minutes, I was like, oh wow, yeah, these are some big minutes that I got here. The Leia moment. I don't necessarily dislike it in theory. Like, I am fine with the idea of it. I don't love the
idea
execution
of what?
Of her, you know, the official explanation is like she made some sort of like force air bubble around herself or something.
I believe so.
You know, and then kind of floats her way back to the ship. And I'm fine with all of that, but I don't. Again, as you kind of refer to it as the Mary Poppins thing, it comes off really strange looking and just doesn't seem Star Wars like. And I'm not one of the Last Jedi haters. I'm very kind of like right down the middle on this movie. But that the reason I brought this up, because this is probably the lamest I have ever felt in a movie theater, in the moment when she then starts floating back toward the ship, it felt so surreal and strange to me that I think it's the only time in my life I've ever done this. I literally pinched myself because I was convinced I was dreaming this moment because it seemed so just out of place to me. But it was not a dream.
How dramatic. You pinched yourself. Yeah. I was sobbing during the scene. And
I was holding it back.
I think I cried. I've cried during pretty much every Star Wars that I've seen in theaters, including Phantom Menace. But I was a little kid. So that's, I totally cried when Qui-Gon died. Oh my gosh. Yeah. My brother and I were ruined at that.
Yeah, but that didn't get me too much. I think I have several years on you, and not that even mattered because I definitely have cried at moments in the new ones. But
I would have cried anyway. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, sure. We'll just say it's because I was a kid. We can okay. No, I've cried during all of the sequels at some point. A lot of the times it was when things that made me nostalgic, it was for the nostalgic points. And this is definitely one of them. And one way that the nostalgia is really stoked here is in the music. So in this scene, we get Leia's theme in a really interesting way. Did it sound like off to you, Tony? Because we recognize her theme, but I don't think we've ever heard it quite like this.
Elaborate. How so?
So when she is first ejected, and she is presumably unconscious, we hear her theme, but it is, I'll play it. It sounds more stagnant than we normally hear it. So we have this like string thing being held. It's more like up here. And then we get like a solo piano or something, or celeste. It's like very static almost. It's like very... Instead of like all of the orchestra in, and it usually feels really flexible and luscious. Right. And here it's like very cold, and it parallels like what we're looking at, I believe, where she looks like she's frozen in space, and the theme literally like thaws with her, it seems. So we get this very icy thing, and then we see her hand kind of move a little bit, and then the theme steps up a little bit. And then we see, I think this is when her eyes open, or like we see that she has made another motion to go. And that's when we get the Force theme. When we see like, oh, she's going to do this. Mm-hmm. And then when she starts flying and it's like, then, you know, like she has gone over that hill and she's going back. Then we full on get her theme again. It goes up, you know, because clearly to establish that like an emotional ascendancy is happening, you raise it a key. So we get the theme again and it goes. And that's when you get the full on like the full on orchestra, and it's faster and it's, there's motion and it's like beautiful and it's very different from the first time we get it, which is like,
right,
because then we get, you know how like the French horns, I think, go like, I was trying to do it, but it's, there's so much happening, it's like, mm-hmm. We get the full, we get that full experience as she's flying back, and it's like a magnetic almost, it's,
yeah,
it's moving so fast, and then as soon as she puts her hand on the door and she's there safe, we get the Force theme and then she's done.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I see what you're saying. See, I think this is one of the things that even surprises me about myself, is that like, obviously, yes, I've noticed the music and I think the music of Star Wars is great. Obviously, John Williams is amazing. But I think this in a way speaks to how good the music is, although this is going to sound like this is what I'm saying, is that like, I tend to like just not even notice it a lot of the times, and that's what makes it effective in a way. You know, it just kind of like, I'm just sort of caught up in it all, and just like, you know, obviously there's never moments that you're like, this music doesn't fit here. It all just makes perfect sense, and yeah. So I think that like while you are better at like, so this is a little different here than how we normally hear it, I'm just kind of like, okay. Yeah, okay, now that you say it, yeah, sure, I see what you're saying, but I think it just wouldn't have even dawned on me.
That's a good point. And, I mean, that's a good point. I do notice it better than you. No, I'm just kidding. the point being that the effectiveness of it, the byproduct of that is sort of that you don't notice it. Yeah. You're not the only musician who has said that on the show already. Where it's like, you would think that I love Star Wars and I'm a musician, but somehow I don't really think about it too much. And I actually would say the same for myself. I do hyperanalyze some things as they're happening, but actually when I'm seeing a Star Wars movie and like when these came, I didn't have these thoughts like right after I left the theater, you know, aside right. from the things I noticed, it's not till like a couple years after that I started like piecing things together and doing that. And more than that, I wasn't even really willing to do that work as soon as I saw the movie. Actually, people mm-hmm. Would ask me for my opinion on the music after each of the new films. And I would always just say, like, I need more time to let it sink in.
Yeah.
Because it's really hard to do it real time when you're also, like, such a fan, just feeling it.
Oh, yeah. And that's
wanted to feel
that's
it.
That's how Yeah, that's how I am with just like even what I think of just the movies as a whole after the first time seeing them. Yeah, I'm always just, I walk out of the theater and friends are always like, "What'd you think?" And I'm like, I don't totally know yet. I need to sleep on it, I think. And then I'll collect my thoughts then and I'll be able to get them out. But yeah, and this movie especially was like, because it was just so not what was quite expected, which in a way was great. Like I that's one thing I do like about it. But yeah, that was like an especially hard one to leave the theater, even knowing what I thought.
Yeah, and I think there's something to be said for being, I guess, sort of reserved in coming to a, you know, firm conclusion on like a score or whatnot. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe I could be more capable of doing that with other films, but with something like Star Wars, it's very difficult because it's like everything potentially emotionally has so many more ramifications than just like, did I objectively see a movie? Good movie? No, I don't. There's no way I go into a Star Wars movie like feeling objectively capable of analyzing that. Yeah. They're just not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Did you, real quick, not music related, but this exact moment we're talking about, this, and again, maybe I'm just learning I'm extremely not observant, because I never caught on until I literally saw someone post something about this online in the moment when Leia is floating back, and then there is the, for some reason, there's the hologram of the, what is it, the supremacist, is that what it's called? The Snoke ship?
Supremacy.
Supremacy. Yeah.
Supremacist works.
I know. I was like, it both sound kind of not bad. Right. But, and she basically, she floats right through it in the middle, basically does a preview of the Holdo maneuver. And obviously on first viewing, you wouldn't catch that. But, on several viewings, I never caught it until it was pointed out to me.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure I didn't either. But it's because there's so many other things to notice.
Yeah,
you're never going to absorb it all at once. Interestingly, I'm pretty sure like you hear a little bit of static as she does that too. Did you hear it?
I think you're right, yeah.
Like the sound confirms that. And I think that is something, it's a unique role that sound plays in a film. Is it doesn't necessarily make you stop and pay attention to it. If it's working, you don't notice it in a jarring way. But one thing it really does do is validate the scenery, basically.
Yeah.
It validates what we're looking at. And if we don't notice it, then great. It means that the sound is, you know, doing its job. And I'll be more specific. It is representing visually what you see and making sure that it makes sense sonically so that you're not seeing someone like slap a table and you're not, and you hear the wrong sound. Like, what if you slapped a table and you heard like, I don't know, a bouncy ball or something.
Right.
It would be incongruous. So the fact that the confirmation of Leia's passing through the hologram, you hear that static blip, it kind of adds another thing in the point of like someone had to design that. And, you know, that was obviously an intentional thing that they wanted.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that still what you're saying is like a lot of times you don't think about it, but I weirdly think I do get like more, weirdly get more into and fascinated by the sound design from these movies than I do the music a lot of the time. And that's not a slam on the music, obviously. But
of course.
Yeah, that's just, I don't know. That's where my, I have like a weird obsession with the making of things. So like I can sit and watch those like old things with Ben Burtt showing how he did all the sound effects and stuff like that. Like I'll eat that up all day long.
I'm super interested in the sound design too.
Yeah.
And the music is sort of, I mean, when we think of the music of Star Wars or like any film, that's a pretty general thing to say because there are so many aspects, and I don't just mean like things that go into it. I just mean, there are so many things contributing to the sonic environment and so many different types of artistry, of creation, of assembly. So, of course, there's like the score writing process. And that is, you know, the matching of action to big themes. And, you know, with John Williams, it would be like leitmotifs as well. And there's that. And then there's the like recording of, which has its own set of choices. Because, you know, as I recently learned, they sometimes record separate cues for the soundtrack and the film.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a whole thing with a set of choices. And then there's, of course, the people that design the sound, that craft, you know, the Foley artists, the ones who create Chewbacca sounds and all that other stuff. But then there's the mixing of all of those elements and deciding when to turn the score down and when to turn the other stuff up. And I think that job in particular is really interesting.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you're...
I never really thought about it. Yeah. Again, another... It's showing how little I think.
No, but I think talking to people who notice different things kind of helps round out our perspectives. And
yeah.
something in the sound mixing in this scene that that is interesting is where I think back to the beginning of the film when there's that other big action sequence, and when Paige was in her own situation with the clicker, mm-hmm. and we zeroed in on her specific location, sound design wise. When we saw people like Captain Kennedy kind of cry out, we weren't actually hearing them scream. We were just seeing on screen them like doing yeah. it without sound coming out. You just see that people are screaming and yelling and whatever. And mm-hmm. here, there are also some notably muted sounds. And what is muted and what is revealed kind of shows the point of view. I mean, I think it kind of guides the viewer's point of view, because like when Leia is in, well, first of all, when the explosion happens, like that's full set, that's sound design. Like we really hear like the explosion. Mm-hmm. Then Leia in space, you don't hear any other music other than her specific, really sparing theme. Mm-hmm. And you don't hear, you know, any other, you know, you're like in the vacuum of space, basically. You don't hear explosions and you don't really hear all that other stuff. When she's floating yeah. back, they're really turning the soundtrack up. Who knows? Maybe there are other things that they could have chosen to let you hear, things blowing up around her, because you can see debris and everything. But right. they really preference, they're really going to go with this emotional moment with this score. And as she's floating by, you kind of hear some things, some debris flying by. But then as soon as she puts her hand on the Raddus to get in, you're in the Raddus's perspective. And I don't know if you remember this, but like it's like as soon you hear her hand slamming on the door from the inside. Mm-hmm. So you're okay. no longer with Leia on the outside. With right. that scene, with that cut, you're then on the inside with Finn, with Poe, with the people like welcoming her back in. You hear all the hustle and bustle inside. So mm-hmm. it's just another interesting thing of.
Yeah, absolutely. Question for you real quick. And so sure. I don't mean to like
no,
derail
please.
All the thoughts, but I'm out of curiosity as someone, a much different type of musician than, you know, I always tell people I just hit stuff. So, but as a person who plays violin and everything, have you ever written like any sort of like orchestral piece?
I've written string orchestra piece.
Okay.
I haven't written a full orchestra. I've only written for string orchestra.
Okay. Because that is something I am fascinated about, that I think about sometimes, is like just thinking about something on this scale with like that big of an orchestra. Like, okay, I understand. I believe John Williams would write on piano, I think. And then, but from there, I'm fascinated by that part of like, with that many band members, like knowing, all right, the violins are going to do this and the trumpets here and the, you know, it's, I don't know how you even, obviously I can understand certain little things here and there, but I guess, I don't know, my drummer brain can't quite wrap my head around even handling all of that.
Well, I think it's actually quite similar to how, I mean, you have experience playing in a band, obviously, in many bands, where I'm sure you've arranged stuff where you kind of intuitively know, okay, mm-hmm. bass, we're going to have a bass doing something like this, you know, guitar doing something yeah. like this. And it's, you're already kind of doing the process of sonically separating. And I think, you know, a lot of that involves just intuitively feeling where the frequencies all, like how the instruments differ in what they can offer.
Yeah.
So you can kind of build that palette, right? So mm-hmm. Like a drum is going to be more percussive than a guitar. So mm-hmm. you would want the drums to be driving rhythm maybe yeah. more than potentially like a violin or something. You mm-hmm. know that you might give the violin melody, like a soaring melody, because you know that they can do slurring and certain techniques. So I think just being really familiar with the orchestra is yeah. how a lot of that just gets started. Also, there are certain range limitations with lots of instruments. Mm-hmm. So you also are limited to like, okay, well, we need something low that feels low end here. So you're not going to give it to violin. You're going to obviously give it to other types of instruments. And then a lot of the rest is probably trends. There are lots of orchestral trends. I don't mean like trends in a bad way, but just, you know, there's a history of certain instruments being used for certain purposes, like ominous purposes or comedic purposes. And who knows how that started, how those started, but it's kind of hard to shake them. It's hard for me to shake them too, just from hearing so much music. And then I'll also say that John Williams or any film composer will have orchestrators. I'm actually going to have someone on the show who is going to provide some more orchestration, tidbits. So I look forward to having Jeremy on the show. But there are people whose job is to do that fleshing out, that arrangement. However, John Williams does a lot of it himself, actually. John Williams is like really unique in that.
See, I did not know that that is like outsourced or whatever you want to say there. But it makes sense because I think that had crossed my mind is like, does one person literally handle all of this or not? Yeah, that makes sense.
I wouldn't know. I don't know if outsourced is, well, depending on the situation, but a lot of the times the composer, if they have a certain style, for example, like the people who orchestrate might know that John Williams is... he's a bad example since he does so much of it by himself, but you know, this is the way that he's going to harmonize woodwinds or something. Like, you kind of know, like, oh, that's how. And especially if it's a theme that's happened before, or you know, there are certain types of templates, not like literal templates, but just once you know a pattern, you kind of can do that pattern. And then also there might be some shorthand involved, like the composer might deliver a theme and then say, put the melody in the violins and put this counter line to the oboe, and you know, with some simple and with instructions like that, someone can carry out the vision and such. But
got it.
It's a whole. Yeah. It's such a big process.
I know. Well, that's what I mean. Is it just seems so like overwhelming? You know, because you're saying, you know, you've played in bands, you kind of know, you know, different instruments do different things. Like, sure, yeah, I get that. But like, you know, in a rock band, you know, you got what, five things tops in most bands, you know, like a couple guitars and bass, and you know, where it's just like five band members and as opposed to, I don't know, how 50 something people, probably more than that.
Right. But in an orchestra, not everyone plays a different part. So if you have 20 violins, they might be on the same part. So you can think of it more as one.
Right.
You're not giving yourself enough credit with that, though, because I think we always tend to think what we know is the easier version of what's out there.
Yeah.
And I have to say, like, growing up in playing in tons of orchestras, and I always wanted to play the drums. Violin, I did want to play for violin and piano, best instruments. Violin's the best instrument in the world. You can't fight me on that. But the other one, if I could play one more instrument, it would be the drums. And
the worst instrument in the world.
my parents would agree, hence me not being a drummer to this day. But when I try to arrange my stuff when I try to do stuff in like a pop or rock context, which, you know, some of my solo music gets into, you know, experimental pop adjacent stuff, you know, and singer-songwriter stuff. Like, I did all that. Whenever I would try to then like get a band behind me instead of just me playing piano and singing or guitar and singing, like, it's hard. It was always very hard for me to conceive of like, how do you do a bass line? Like, what do the drum, like, how do I even, like, I get very tripped up. To this day, I get very tripped up. I open my session and I'm like, all right, it's going to add some bass and drums. Yay. I don't really, I'm not good at this.
Well, again,
I'm like, maybe... oh, sure. I'll arrange a string arrangement. Sure. Great.
Right. Yeah, I think this maybe kind of falls in the what we were talking about earlier of the just those things that you don't notice or think about. It's just sort of there, and you maybe like here. Obviously, you've heard tons of rock music your whole life, and then you know, you might not like, you might notice a bass line, but you're not really thinking about what's happening necessarily. And then when it comes time to then try and do that yourself, you're like, wait, yeah, how does somebody play the bass? It becomes so much more difficult. Yeah.
And those moments are always revealed when you're trying to explain it to someone, which is part of the reason I like doing projects like this, because I am not someone who really had words to explain the things that I intuitively knew about music my whole life. And I just remember when I was an ear training TA in grad school, trying to teach people how to train their ears. And I just hear things really easily.
Yeah.
And I couldn't explain like how I recognize that when you play this, I just know that's like a G diminished seventh. I don't know how to explain how to get from not knowing to just knowing.
Right.
And so it took me a long time to really try to, and I think that's where theory comes in. It's not like necessary to your own solo experience of understanding music, but for me, the biggest use has been when I'm trying to communicate about it to other people.
Yeah.
Using a language.
Yeah. Yeah. The more I think about what I'm doing, the worse I will play.
Yeah.
I need to just sort of like zone out and do what I think should be happening.
Me too.
And then if someone, I can't tell you how many times people have come up to me and like asked me about a specific drum part in a specific song or something. And I'm like, I don't know. Like it's like hard for me to even like think in that moment of like, I don't know. What do I do? I just sort of do it. I don't know. And then I can remember specific moments of being on stage and thinking about how the day before somebody asked me about this part in a song, and then that I get to that song and that part comes and I start thinking about it, and then that's when I screw it up every night then.
You bring up, that's such a good point. I'm really glad that you named that, because I think that is the trap that a lot of us fall into when we try to analyze Star Wars music or any music. And that's generally the problem I have with music analysis, which is why I try to be very clear that like what I say about this music is my opinion and what it means to me, and definitely clouded by stuff and definitely adding all of my own layers of assumptions and, you know, not necessarily the same thing as retconning, but sort of doing a version of that, when really a lot of the times, if you listen to John Williams interviews, he's like, I don't know. Sometimes he does know, but sometimes it really is like, it just sounded cool there. You know, it's not like he's thinking, I'm going to build this theme so that it has like fourths and fifths, and then it's got to have a descending thing because, you know, light, dark side, and it's got to have like, I think a lot of that is just intuitive, and us on the outside can take the frameworks that we know about music theory and be like, oh, that does a thing that has this symbolism and that's why it does that. But we don't, at the end of the day, we don't really know. And there's not really necessarily one reason. There's just patterns that we can recognize and it might mean something to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think about these types of things a lot, but then I not enough to learn more, I guess. I don't know. but yeah, I like literally will think about that sometimes. Like, this is something I've been meaning to actually learn more about, is literally just the history of music. Like, literally, like, because I think about, like, somebody invented a guitar. Like, these people, like, say, these notes sound good together. And like, you know, and then everything goes, I don't know. It seems so basic, but that is a thing that I have been thinking about lately, of just like kind of fascinated on how it all just became a thing.
Yeah, I'll spare you on that. It's I don't want to get too in the weeds with that.
Yeah, sorry.
I get really interested in that too, because I start thinking about like evolution, and then I start thinking about like when all the people started like plucking stuff, just noticing that a certain type of string could make a sound, and then starting using their voices, and then starting to recognize things. And then I try to think about, then I think about physics and how some of it is like, there are, it's not all like mysterious music. It is like sound is just waves, air, it's just air moving through space really, and just sound waves. So there are certain things that you could be like, well, an octave is like the frequency is doubled, the amount of hertz is doubled. There are certain physical properties that lead us to musical things that that maybe make us feel certain sensations, but outside of that, it's a little bit wild to me sometimes when we look at all this film music, and there are so many steps along the way to get to where we are now of like, this sounds good and that's how we're going to do this. And like, now we have this whole performance, this whole separate like performance art, this whole discipline that has its own set of conventions and things we expect. It's so big to think about.
Yeah. Cause it's, you know, yes, there are different keys and in the, you know, this, no, that's not the right note for this key, or things like that. It's like, but sure, that is the standard. But like, what if you write a thing and you're like, that chord doesn't fit this, but I like the way that sounds. You know, we actually I can tell you a specific thing of that. Of on the first Motion City soundtrack record, there is a song called "Autographs and Apologies," and there is kind of like pre-chorus moment, everything drops out and it's just piano and voice, and there's one chord that happens, and Ed Rose, who was the producer of that record, when it got to that chord, he was like, that chord's not right, and he's like, it should be this, and like told us what it should be, and it was, you know, he was right, like but we were all just sort of like, we all liked the wrong one better, and we like, we're gonna keep it that way. And literally, and he made us do this like somewhat as a joke, but also he was very serious. In the liner notes of that record, there's something about Ed Rose wipes his hands clear of this chord in "Autographs and Apologies."
Oh my gosh, I really want, does it say in the liner notes what the alternate was?
I can't remember. I could go grab the record if you want me to. I forget exactly the phrasing.
Do it, okay. And I'll keep riffing on this scene. So now that Tony's gone, I can tell you the real stuff. Seriously though, I think the point about Leia, the point of view that the sound can help us feel as viewers, is really critical, and it's something that I want to keep paying more attention to in The Last Jedi. Something else that I want to bring up is when Kylo is about to press the button, we get a similar orchestral rise, a similar orchestral crescendo that we had when Paige was having her moment at the beginning of the film. It's sort of like this lead up and then it's sudden drop out to nothing, and it kind of, it really focuses your attention on that close-up of the button without any music to distract you, without anything else to distract you. So that is my point about music directing your attention and sound directing your attention. All right, Tony, you're back.
I am back. There's no, it does not say the specific chord, but the phrasing is Ed Rose wipes his hands of the eight. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It does say that. It says, Ed Rose wipes his hands of the A major chord in "Autographs and Apologies," played on piano, as it is not musically correct.
Wow, he went there. Musically correct. I don't really want to live in a world where things have to be musically correct.
That's right. We're a rock band, man. You know, we don't play by the rules.
Oh my gosh. And this was this was in the pre-chorus?
I guess you would call it the pre-chorus, yeah.
Okay, well, great. For those watching on YouTube, I'm going to put an end card that has, like, you know, recommend the next video or whatever. I'm going to point to this, reference, if you want to hear it. Yes. So anyway, back to The Last Jedi.
No,
it's okay. What is there anything else? Oh, I mean, there's a lot more to say, but I'll let you continue with if you had any other thoughts before we move on to the next kind of scene.
No, I don't think necessarily in this particular moment anything else comes to mind right away.
One more thing. When Finn picks up the homing beacon, we do hear Rey's chimes theme. Or we hear...
Wait, I don't think...
Not the chimes theme. We hear one of... It's just a very short... I think it's like... Is it... And then we maybe hear just like a couple more notes and then it fades and then it goes to the Chewie scene. But it's sort of like, I mean, the homing beacon symbolizes Rey because that's how they're going to be reunited is through that. And we see it falling from Leia's hand. Well, I'm impressed that Leia held it while she was flying back, if you think about it. So the homing beacon falls out of Leia's hand when she's on the stretcher. Finn picks it up and that's when we hear Rey's theme, because obviously Finn is thinking about Rey.
What else is new?
What else is new? And then we have, well, we skipped over the part actually where we have Hux and Peepy, and they're in the big echoey room on top in the Supremacy, and they are, you know, they're mad. The Resistance have pulled out of reach. We can't cover you at the distance. Return to the fleet. What's the point of this if we can't blow up three tiny cruisers? They are faster and lighter, sir. They can't lose us, but they can keep out of range where our cannons are not effective against their shields. Well, keep up the barrage. Let's at least remind them that we're still here. Very good, sir. They won't last long burning fuel like this. It's just a matter of time. So in that moment, we get don't really get much music. We just get some like rumbly underscore. The front and center is really just their voices, and it's really scary.
Yeah. That actually, that was my note. Watching the 5 minutes that I knew we were going to be talking about today, it actually is. There's a few moments, obviously, of the music being very upfront and what's going on. But a lot of it's either very subtle or moments of kind of nothing there. Which sort of surprised me. And in a way, it felt like, oh, good. Maybe I'm getting off easy here with not talking about music theory.
But just because there's not music doesn't mean there's not sound.
That's true.
Music is just a type of sound that is organized in a specific way. We do actually hear music, though, but it's underscore. And just you barely hear it. And actually, if you're following along with the soundtrack, this is actually where there's a pause in the track. I did take a note of this for the people following that. So the end of the Supremacy track, which is track 4, corresponds to about 30:05 of the film. No, sorry. 2:05 of track 4, which is sort of the end, corresponds to 30:05 of the film. And that's when we get Kylo and Leia's close-ups. And then at 2:30 of the soundtrack, it diverges. The film adds more as it usually does. And then the scene changes to the PV and Hux, and that's when it stops again. And then when it comes back, we pick up on the soundtrack. So it's kind of just like the soundtrack just has like a little pause and then we come back to it and then finish it out. And the soundtrack number 4, Supremacy, ends with the Rey's little theme as Finn picks up the homing beacon. And then again, there's no music. So that's how that works. And the voices really are front and center on the Supremacy, as they often are in the First Order scenes. Have you noticed that?
I can't say that I've noticed it, but I mean, I guess it seems appropriate. Like, because I feel like when you think of, like, you know, the villains obviously there's like the Imperial March thing, but obviously not in these movies necessarily, but I don't know. It feels like, I don't know, when the villains are talking or something, I feel like at most, what do you get? Just sort of like a droning, you know, just some sort of droning note under it or something like that, if anything. Because, yeah, I don't know. It seems be a little distracting otherwise, maybe?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I think that's common for dialogue scenes. Probably there's usually less music and dialogue to help us understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also wonder if, and I didn't think about this until just today when I was like, there's always so much reverb when the First Order is talking. Like, they're always in these big cavernous rooms. And I just feel like there's the reverb is just very, it's really accentuated in those spaces. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about what that might mean. And, well, what's your experience with reverb, like using it as a musician? Do you like it? Do you not like it? When do you use it?
It needs to be used sparingly, usually, unless you're going for, you know, a very specific effect. I think, like, it should be pretty subtle. And, one of the types of things that you kind of barely notice. But then it maybe if it's taken away, then it's going to sound weird to you. Like, I always, like, if I'm recording something that I sang on, you know, I always have a touch of reverb on my voice, because otherwise it just sounds too dry and it doesn't work for me. But yeah,
what is the effect that it has, the reverb? Like, because reverb, of course, distorts the, you know, sound in some way. It kind of muffles isn't the right word, but it changes, definitely, it changes what you're hearing.
Yeah.
And it signifies, it's hard to explain. Like, if you think about what reverb physically is, it is just like millions of sound waves reflecting off of surfaces, right? So that's why in a very big space, if you're projecting from the front of a cathedral, like to the back, there's going to be a delay because it's going to take a while. And you might hear like an echo even in some places, which, and I guess when I hear the First Order speaking and I hear so much reverb, it subtly cues my mind to like, they're in a big room. There's not a lot of stuff in there. It's cavernous. It like, it's a cold feeling to hear that. Like if I were talking to you here and you see that like there's a couch behind me and there was like booming reverb, I feel like that might look like I'm speaking from a different place than I'm actually sitting.
Right.
It would be really jarring because it would mismatch the room. And I think, and I think that's something that might be a certain Star Wars trend. It might be like a established continuity sound-wise that I'll have to like now watch all the movies again and think about like when there's evil stuff, are they always in a big room and a very spacious room? Like there's not like soft couches everywhere to kind of soak up the sound waves. It's just this reverberating thing. It does not sound cozy in there. It sounds like, I don't know, it sounds like Hux, and you hear every like, you hear the end of his pristine syllables like kind of ping off the space.
Yeah. I think you're onto something. This might surprise you. Not something I ever thought about.
Well, if you're listening to this and there's no music and you think there's no music to analyze in this scene, pro tip, assess the reverb situation. Are you hearing a reverberation? That might tell you something about the room that they're in and the lack of furniture. Or how their decor is, because if you're in a room that sounds like that, you're not exactly having velvet everywhere. You probably have some very cold, some very hard walls, some very definitely like hardwood floor. That's not a carpet sound.
Yeah.
And that tells you something. Like I feel like when you're cozy in Luke's hut, even though things are a little bit tense, you do not hear that much reverb. You sound like you're really in a smaller place, and there's stuff.
And that's just a good rule of thumb in life. When you go somewhere, assess the reverb situation.
This is so true. I don't trust places with tons of reverb and no people around.
Nor should you.
No. All right, so now we have Chewy roasting porgs. One porg. Yes. A full rotisserie porg.
One porg that we know of.
True.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this whole next part?
I it got a chuckle out of me the first time I saw it. I think the thing I always think about is you know, I joked one porg that we know of, but yeah, what do you think? Because we cut before anything. We don't ever see him like discard it then or anything. You know, he looks guilty and he gives a little frustrated growl there. But what do you think? You think he gave up, or you think he still ate it?
I think he gave up on that one.
Yeah.
I don't know if I think that because of something I've read, or yeah, and not that he never ate porg ever again, but maybe. I don't think Chewie's like going vegetarian anytime soon. I don't think he probably can with his species. That's but true. I feel like he definitely is taking pause there, and you know, he's kind of made friends with some of the porgs, and kind mm-hmm. of they're kind of his buddies while like Ray and Luke are doing all their dramatic stuff.
Yeah.
Chewie's been chilling with the porgs, and we get that very pitiful looking exchange with their eyes and with the sounds that they're making. Like there's no dialogue. I mean, no dialogue in English or basic.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really, sound design's time to shine.
Yeah. Yeah. What do we really hear? We hear just the porgs making their little porg noises, and what maybe there's a fire too, right? That we're hearing, I think.
Yeah. There's like a crackling fire.
Yeah.
And we also hear, we hear not just like stock porg sounds. Like it's clear that they didn't just make one porg sound and then press the porg button on the mixer. It's clear that they have a porg sound, but it's still like emoting, because we heard many different types of noises, and same with Chewy, of course. We hear lots of, like, I feel like without looking at the scene I could hear that and know that there's some sort of a thing happening between them, and and Chewy is like kind of regretful and feels bad at the end. Like I can hear that in his voice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I do think yeah, they do a good job with that in this scene, but I can't remember any specifics in this movie necessarily, but I do kind of think in the newer movies as a whole, while I, you know, love most of them, I do think they've kind of been a little lazy here and there with some of that. Like, 'cause I definitely have noticed specific sounds reused.
I'm intrigued. Which ones?
I guess you could argue that, well, he could make the same sound, but there's definitely specific BB-8 sounds that I have noticed in being used multiple times. And again, I could see, you know, the like arguing that he's speaking and maybe he's saying something we've heard him say before. But I've definitely noticed it, because I think why I noticed it especially was because I did a theme song for another Star Wars podcast once, and using some BB-8 samples. And so I got very familiar with like a handful of specific noises he makes. And so now whenever I hear those, I'm like, oh, there's the one. Like, they're from Force Awakens. And I feel like, again, I can't remember specifically if that happens in this movie, but it is a thing that I have noticed.
Interesting. That was actually a question that I didn't really know how to ask you, because it's not really a fully formed question, but it sort of is. Like, I know that obviously you've done a ton of Star Wars covers. Like, what is the process of like when you're doing that, basically what are you learning? Like, what does that experience teach you? And that's one thing, you know, just a byproduct of the experience of arranging and performing music. Mm. You learn new things about the music and make new connections. How do you go about picking a song to cover? And what's the first part that you're going to
I mean, that hasn't happened too often, honestly. Like, I've written a lot of, like, silly Star Wars songs, but...
Oh, they're not covers, necessarily.
No. I have done, like, for our Star Wars Minute Pals, I've done the, like, closing music a few times, and that's been... With the exception of the Last Jedi season, that was, like, just one of, the silly songs I'd written. And then, but in the past, there were certain songs that they came to me. Because you did one of them. They probably did the same for you, so I would assume.
Well, yeah, because they came to me.
Oh, you did? Okay. Because they've always told me, like, would you want to do a version of Rey's
actually, they did that for me, too. But, Yeah, but I planted the seed in my minutes because I had recorded my minutes before I recorded the theme because they were very ahead of that season. Oh, no, I'm giving giving secrets away. But I had mentioned on the podcast that that was my favorite track from the movie. And so then when they asked me to do the theme, they were just referencing, hey, you liked that that song.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's so they've just told me what they wanted, and then I think they sort of know what I will do generally, because I feel like stuff I write tends to kind of be in the same ballpark. I kind of turn it into a rock song, and then usually we'll just do whatever like the melody is, just like on a use kind of a Moog sound or something, and I don't know. That just tends to kind of be my wheelhouse. So I don't, unless something really comes to mind, like that it might be cool to try it this way, that's usually what I will go for.
Do you find yourself changing the key?
No. Because I think I'm not smart enough to do that.
So you listen to it and then play along with it?
Yeah, I'll listen to it and then just try to like find the notes and then learn it. And then once I learn it, then I kind of just twist it into a rock song instead.
Cool. Wow. I love how everyone has such a different process.
Mine's very basic. But but I think that is probably it's good for me because it does sort of like I have to like learn how to play it. But on the other hand, I didn't really learn anything because I'm not afterwards going, okay, this was in F, so like there's none of that happening. It's just like, okay, I figured out this is how you play it. Don't ask me anything about it, but this is how you play it.
So one byproduct for me is that I just sort of like how now you recognize those BB-8 sounds just because you spent so much time with them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very attuned to when my theme comes up anywhere. So right. Very attuned to if there's ever, like, I don't know if I would have caught in minute six or something that Battle of the Heroes had a small quotation. It's the only time in the sequel trilogy where Battle of the Heroes comes up. I don't know if I, even though I love that track, I don't know if I would have so instantly been like, oh, that's Battle of the Heroes, if I hadn't spent all that time making a cover.
Yeah.
So.
No, that's a good point. I did a similar thing.
So I bet you're like have a spidey sense with the ones that you've done. Just.
Yeah, I can specifically remember. I forgot that I did this until you said this, but yeah, because I did for Star Wars Minute the love theme from Attack of the Clones, and I remember when they came to me and asked if I would do that. Like that was one that immediately in my head I'm like I don't even know if I know what that is. Like I had to listen to it to place it, and even then it wasn't like a standout to me, you know what I mean? Like in listening back to it, it didn't just go, oh, it's this one. It was kind of like, oh, this is some Star Wars music that I it's not unfamiliar, but I'm definitely it doesn't sound like a song I've heard a million times.
That's so interesting.
Wow. but then now I will notice it.
Yeah,
you were saying, but yeah, at the time I did not know what it was.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of like what we personally know on a deep level, that whatever we as humans, I guess, have spent a lot of time with, especially if we've played it or done it or just, you know, it's been part of our lives in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Once that's drilled in, that's what we're primed to mm-hmm. hear. And since yeah. everyone has different things, that's where a lot of mismatches can arise. Unless mm-hmm. we're like open-minded and, you know, all whatever that is. Who knows?
This just popped into my head. Really, this isn't about these specific myths, but real quick. One thing I do remember noticing when going to see The Force Awakens, you know, because that was such a big, okay, this first new one in 10 years at that point. And, you know, that excitement of going in and you know, there's always that first moment of getting the opening there. And I remember immediately thinking, oh, that very first hit was like not as powerful as it usually as they always used to be. Did you pick up on that?
On the opening crawl?
Yeah, literally just the bah! Right up the very first thing you hear. I feel like in the newer movies it's not as powerful as it is in the old ones.
Interesting.
Yeah,
there are definitely differences between them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that was like immediate. Like I immediately was like, that didn't seem like it just didn't have enough to it. I don't know. For my taste.
That is so interesting. A lot of people have said that.
Really?
And a lot of people have noticed the differences. In uh-huh. fact, the first guest I had on here, we talked a lot about the opening titles since she played on the sequel trilogy.
Uh-huh.
And we talked about some tuning differences between London and here, and also recording technology
mm-hmm.
With THX just being new in the old films.
Mm-hmm.
And so just the quality of that. And then also just the fact that they record it new every time. And John Williams, yeah. you know, might do it a different way. Also, you know how it is with mastering. There's like loudness wars and there's like mm-hmm. all these, there's so much pressure to compress more
yeah.
and it could just I don't have an answer because yeah I mean that sounds valid who
yeah,
knows why
I,
it could be a ton of things but
mm-hmm.
yeah
yeah, yeah. I assumed it was a choice but I don't know yeah it just definitely like immediately stood out to me and I do think it got a little better with the movies that followed but still, I still felt like they were a little weaker compared to the old ones.
So personally, I didn't notice. That's just something I didn't notice. Yeah. So I don't notice everything for sure. I know for a fact that I wasn't even, if I noticed, I don't remember that I noticed. I think I was just so overcome with emotion that I
right.
wasn't. Also, I did not see the originals in theaters. Mm. So
yeah, I only remember, I saw Jedi in the theater. That's the only one I can remember seeing in the theater when I was a kid. So I was like 5
yeah.
when Jedi came out. So
my first theater was Jedi Special Edition.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you got to, yeah, experience that sweet Jedi rocks on the big screen.
It's all I've ever seen. I don't have the originals. No one does.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a big
conversation
a big
for another day.
For yeah. yeah. I'm very anti Jedi rocks.
Oh, I love it. It's so that's my childhood is Jedi rocks. But hey, we all have our things. So
that's right. I'm a lapty neck man.
So this is when Old Friends track 6 starts playing. It's after the Chewie Porg moment. It's when Luke enters the Millennium Falcon. So we get Old Friends, track 6, on the Last Jedi soundtrack. And that track actually plays up until the end of this 5-minute segment. So it goes from the beginning up until 1:45. And yeah, just pretty straight ahead, that track.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sound design that goes on top of it too. So it's actually interesting watching the film and then listening to the soundtrack. And you know it's like the same, you know it's happening, but you know what is being bolstered in the film. And I think the moment where R2 lights up is one mm-hmm. specific one, because there's like these violin trills. It's like, it sounds kind of sparkly. And then it, again, there's like a little sudden key change. It's like, it goes up. And it gives you kind of that magical feel, that kind of like, oh, there's a spark of an old friend, and it's, what could this be? It actually reminds me of when you're playing Pokemon Go and you're using the AR part, and you start seeing sparkles because you know that's when the Pokemon's showing up. Anyway.
Sure, I know exactly what you're talking about.
So, yeah, you get that with R2, and then you hear R2 making his beeps and stuff. When you listen to the soundtrack, you do hear the violins doing that sparkly thing, but you don't hear it with R2's noises, obviously.
Right.
So,
do you think, and this is something I never thought about until this moment, do you think that R2 has ever influenced perhaps the key of any of these, or vice, or the key of the song? Like, you know what I'm getting at here, since he's very,
yeah,
like, notes basically that he's pumping out. I never really thought about that. If they clash at all, or
they try
anything?
To adjust things to, yeah, kind of. I think about that a lot with like diegetic beeps happening. There is in the last set of minutes, you hear like before the, I forgot what it is, before Admiral Akbar makes his thing, you hear this like beep 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 beep, and it's very much on a specific. You can detect what note it is, and I think about that. I bet sometimes they do adjust things.
Yeah.
But I don't know, again.
Yeah, it seems minor enough that it probably no, but yeah, I don't know. I never thought about it till right now.
You know, it's funny. It's like when you're tracking something and the metronome is kind of on a pitch and you're playing something and it really clashes with the metronome. It can be jarring, but it can also be very helpful. Because of the distinction. So if I'm using a metronome that has kind of a dull, like, and I'm playing something in C, which is the note that I'm playing, then I can't really hear the metronome because it gets lost.
Right.
Because it matches so much with what I'm already playing.
Yeah.
So having something jarringly different is helpful.
Yeah.
I bet they have. I bet they have had to adjust something at some point, though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know famously that he did the main theme in the same key as the 20th Century Fox fanfare.
Oh, is that why?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's a good idea. Yeah, those flow together so, like, seamlessly in my mind.
Yeah, that was intentional.
Did not know. Learned something. Cool.
Yeah. I'll throw a have you ever heard the, it's called The Soundtrack Show? It's a podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great podcast. But that's,
did they mention that on there?
Yeah, I believe that's where I first had heard that fact.
Yeah, remind me who the host is.
David W. Collins, I believe is his name.
That's right.
Yes.
I'll have to get him on this show.
Yeah, it's a great show. I really like that show.
We had a tweet exchange in which we sort of disagreed on something.
Ooh.
In The Last Jedi. But it was like the kind of disagreement that I love, because I just like having other opinions. Actually, on the last episode with Liz, we had different interpretations of what Leia's theme could mean in that scene as well. But I like that because it demonstrates the point that, like, we can take the same source material and people with different experiences will lay on different meanings that can be valid. And as long as you just, like, acknowledge, oh, I can see how you see that, and not like, oh, mine is right. Mine is the one John Williams wanted. This is the explanation. As long as you don't like hold on too much to what is meaningful to you, I think that's totally fine. And I think it's awesome because it's like, I don't know, it just opens my eyes to like, oh, yeah. You could see it that way too. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a very adult way of thinking that I admittedly was terrible at for years and have gotten much better about myself in my old age now.
That's funny. So in this theme, we get in this set of, you know, this is when Leia's hologram gets played. We hear the Force theme leading up to that. It sounds kind of dark, though. It sounds like there's a counter. It's like, I don't know, this is the wrong key, but mm-hmm. Do you kind of hear that going? That's mm-hmm. always running in the background, I feel, of Luke's music in this movie. Now that I've noticed it so many times, I'm going to have to go back and dive more into that. It's only something I noticed from doing these minutes.
Yeah.
It's like oftentimes when the Force theme comes on or when Luke is there, you get some like sort of adjacent to Dies Irae stuff happening. Mm-hmm. Or... I can't remember what it is, but you get some versions of some of that stuff.
Yeah.
Then we get Leia's theme.
Picked up on that either.
And then we get Leia's theme a few times when they're playing, when he's playing, or when R2's playing Leia's mm-hmm. original Help Me Obi-Wan Kenobi mm-hmm. thing. It's interesting, and maybe, that they play Leia's theme there and they don't play Luke and Leia's theme. They play Leia's theme.
See, this is I'm surprised myself with these things sometimes. what is Luke and Leia's theme?
Oops.
Okay. Yeah, because it's there's certain ones that again, it's that thing of like sometimes it like just fits so appropriate that I there, you know, certain things, like I can tell you this for an exact example of this, even Leia's theme for years, like obviously like I would recognize it as being Star Wars, but I think somebody, like this was probably only like 5 years ago or something, someone said something about referenced Leia's theme, and I honestly wasn't sure what they were talking about. And then once I think it literally was the thing where I just looked it up, then I was like, oh, it's this one. I never like put that together for some reason. And I guess this is another one of those for me.
It's also super confusing because Leia has like three themes. There's Leia's theme, Luke and Leia, and Han and Leia.
Right.
So you just hear her stuff a lot.
Yeah.
But a lot, it fits, so it's not like hitting you on the top. Oh God, I'm really bad at idioms. It's like my thing. Hitting you on the head, over the head. Hitting you on, it's not hitting you over the head with, okay, now we're going to blast this theme, and we'll do now this theme. It's like an Easter egg. It really seamlessly fits, and I think that's something so amazing. Throughout 9 films, you still have these themes that you can fit in without it being like, oh, now we have theme number 5. Like, of course.
Yeah.
It all fits together, and there's associations between related themes, and I think that's such a beautiful thing, too. In Luke and Leia's theme, the first intervals are actually the same first intervals as the Star Wars main title. And so there are a lot of themes like that where it's easy to like get your wires crossed.
Yeah.
Like I'll just like, and then they all start with that. And there's just a lot of those. There's also Leia's theme and Han and Leia's theme both start with a major sixth. That's Leia. Leia and Han is...
Right.
Oops.
Right.
But they both start with that. So, easy to get them all mixed up.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm not stupid.
Yeah, that was the point of that whole
thing.
Thank
you, Chrysanthi. Thank you.
So, I'm supposed to... Listener Matt Berkey says hello to you.
Hello, listener Matt Berkey.
And also, this is a question from Tucat. What, if you had to make an alien puppet band for a Star Wars movie, what different sci-fi instruments, or, you know, any, or normal instruments, whatever, what instruments would you put in there?
Yeah, I don't even know that I can name that many sci-fi instruments. Like, I remember the...
I think that's fine. Just
create
on the spot, like, at least think contribute one member, and I'll tell you one member that I would put.
Okay. I'm putting Salacious Crumb in this band.
Oh.
And I want him to play a didgeridoo because I just the mental image of that is
would
it
be a miniature didgeridoo?
No, or... I think I want a full size. He's gonna adapt to play this full size.
Yeah. That would require some help. He might not be very good at it. But you know what?
I never said he was
I'm not one to say who's gonna be, you know. Who knows? Who knows what Salacious Crumb can do with that?
All right.
I would put in a Star Wars band. First of all, I wish that I had the job of creating diegetic, like, in-world Star Wars musicians. Yeah. I just would like to do that. And there needs to be, okay, we've had lots of drummers, like percussion instruments. We've had like marimba types of things. We've had... lots of singers. There's been no, to my knowledge, violin type thing. So,
yeah.
Has there been someone with a bowed string instrument?
There was, I believe, in, I can't say for sure if it was bowed, but there were definitely some stringed instruments in Force Awakens.
Okay.
In Maz's castle, in that band.
Oh,
there.
Yeah.
I forget
okay.
what that band is called.
I feel,
but yeah, I can't remember if there was a bow, but I'm pretty sure there was something with strings.
I would have noticed if it was something that looked like a violin, though.
Yeah.
And that's what I want. I want there to be a character that plays the violin, but it, you know, but Star Wars it up. Don't make it look like an Earthling 18th century violin. Uh-huh. Make it look like Star Wars.
Yeah, that is a pet peeve of mine when some, like, every now and then they'll, like, something is a little too earthy. It's rare, but I feel like they've done it a few times. Like, I think the one that immediately comes to mind is the not music instruments.
The water
but,
bottles.
Well, yeah, water bottles, right. That's a good point. I was going to say on The Mandalorian, with the scene when Grogu was eating some macaroons.
Yeah, actually,
it's like
the
just
one
like
that
straight
I
straight up macaroons.
The one that is my pet peeve. I mean, I don't really care. It just really stuck out to me in Mandalorian was the spatchka when they were like at the bar and they're like, "I'll have some spatchka." I'm like, "You couldn't think of something that doesn't sound like scotch and vodka?"
Yeah, good call there. I don't think I put that together in my head, but at the same time, I think I only went as far as that sounds like scotch, and then I didn't even put the vodka thing in there. Yeah, good call.
Yeah. So this string instrument, I'm still on. I've thought about this for years of this instrument that needs to be in Star Wars because the bow needs to have some sort of like, there needs to be some way that it doubles as a weapon.
Right.
Man, just I think it's a missed opportunity, and I think it should be in the Obi-Wan show.
There you go. Yeah. There's plenty of stuff coming. You got plenty of chances. So
yeah. Well, this was a really fun conversation, Tony. Thank you for joining me.
Absolutely, it was super fun. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
What are your current podcasts? Where can people find you these days? I'm wearing my Christmas shirt for you.
I noticed that. I had not commented on that yet.
Tony had a podcast called Feliz Nobby Pod, and it was Christmas every day on that podcast, right?
Yes, it's very silly, but it was fun. I do genuinely love Christmas, and it was an excuse to talk about Christmas and hang out with friends and act like an idiot. But yeah, haven't been doing that one in a while. I currently host a podcast called Bizarre Albums. Where every week episodes are like 15, 20 minutes. They're just quick, but tell the story about just strange albums released by like actors, athletes, fictional characters, or sometimes just bands or artists that took like a really sudden left turn that didn't fit with everything else they do. And it's never making fun of these things. I'm just genuinely fascinated by them. So I just do a ton of research about these and try to just present the story of these albums. So check that out. And as I said, quick listen, 15, 20 minutes usually. So check that out if you can. That's my main thing. But yeah, I also play drums in a band called Don't Stop or We'll Die, which is kind of a comedy, weird comedy band. And there's a podcast for that now as well called Song a Week. And every week we put out a new song. So
wow,
yeah,
you're very prolific. And where can people follow you? You're at Tony Thaxton.
Yes, right? At Tony Thaxton on both Twitter and Instagram.
Cool. Wow. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I actually didn't know that exactly about. Yeah, I didn't know that about Bizarre Albums. That it was like actually real albums.
Yeah, yeah. It's and there's a couple of I've done two Star Wars episodes so far because I did the Miko disco Star Wars, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I did the Star Wars Christmas album as well. So.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
Yeah. Which Miko was involved in that too, which I didn't realize. But yeah, it's always full of just fun little trivia nuggets, kind of. And yeah, it's fun. If you like this kind of thing, people might enjoy it.
Awesome. Well, listeners, if you have any favorite sound-related moments in The Last Jedi or in any of the films, definitely send me an email at podcast@starwarsmusicminute.com or just tweet at me. Or I also have a link in the show notes to submit an anonymous question. I have gotten emails and submissions, one of them being to get Tony on the show. And all I can say so far is every single question that I've gotten has been really a great question. So thank you. Thank you for that. Give me lots to think about, actually.
Nice.
Next week, we're back with minutes 36 through 40. And that's all. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Star Wars Music Minute.